One of the most frequently occurring queries about the Masonic festive board in England concerns the origin and meaning of the fire that follows the drinking of a toast. But before dealing directly with this, I think it would be helpful to consider certain related customs. Customs from which I don't say that Masonic fire necessarily originated, but customs which nevertheless may in all probability have had an indirect influence on the development of the practice. We might, for instance, think of the custom which is still observed of firing salutes of guns to mark anniversaries or state occasions. Then there was a tradition going a long way back of a salute in the form of a cannon shot or volley of musketry being fired to mark the drinking of toasts at a banquet. Shakespeare, writing 400 years ago, introduced just such a custom in the tragedy of Hamlet, in which, on two occasions, when the king proposes and drinks a toast, the stage directions call for the trumpets and cannon shot to mark it. There are also accounts to be found in 17th and 18th century writings, newspaper reports, and so on, of gunfire or volleys similarly marking the drinking of toasts. An early one is recorded in connection with the Preston Guild, a trade festival held annually in the city of Preston in Lancashire by the guild merchants, and marked by church services, processions, and general festivities. An account written in the 1660s tells how the mayor, with a guard of soldiers and representatives of the various trade companies, went in procession to each of the town gates where toasts were drunk, each being followed with a volley of shot from the musketeers. An instance of gunfire marking the drinking of toasts at a Masonic meeting is recorded at one held by an Irish lodge, number 27, at the courthouse in Cork on the 24th of June, 1751, being the anniversary of our holy patron St. John the Baptist, as the record has it. After the election of officers, we are told that the evening was, and I quote, dedicated to mirth and jollity. No more business was transacted. And then the account continues, when dinner was served up, a band of music continued their performance for the remainder of the evening. Every toast was proclaimed to the other lodgers of the city by a discharge of cannon procured for that purpose. Apart from the analogy of these traditions, we must remember, too, the nature of 18th-century society and of its drinking customs in general. It was the age of the coffee house and the club, the age of gourmandising and of gout. It had noisy and rumbustious drinking customs and ways of honouring toasts. Nor are we the only organisation that has a tradition of fire following toasts. The Honourable Artillery Company, for example, has its own regimental fire, the actions of which are accompanied by the call zay, 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 repeated 9 times. So when and where did the custom of Masonic fire grow up? The earliest descriptions of the practice we know of are found in some French exposures of the late 1730s and 1740s. But before going on to consider these, I ought perhaps to say a word or two about what are called exposures, for the benefit of those not familiar with them. Ever since the earliest days of organized Freemasonry, and even before, broadsheets, pamphlets, and books have been in circulation, claiming to expose, or disclose, a better word, what their authors to be the ceremonies and secrets of Freemasonry. They were particularly prolific in the 18th century, and although by their very nature they were necessarily suspect, since they were published out of malice to do the craft harm, or for motives of private gain, or both, yet if they are studied sufficiently critically, they do give us an idea of the Masonic practices of the time, for want of anything better, for this was long before the days of the printed ritual books. One of the best known and most important of the early English exposures, Samuel Pritchard's Masonry Dissected, came out in 1730 and caused something of a sensation in Masonic circles. It held the field for the next 30 years, until a flood of further publications began to appear in the 1760s. In the meantime, several new ones were being published in France, and these were a good deal more detailed than anything that had come on the scene before. They showed that the lively and fertile imagination of French masons was already at work elaborating and embellishing the basic, and perhaps rather stolid, system of Freemasonry that had been exported to France from England. These French exposures not only give quite detailed accounts of the degree ceremonies and the floor work in lodge, but they also have equally detailed descriptions of the after proceedings, or the table lodge, as they call it. I have put together a composite description of the table lodge and the toasting routine observed at it from two of them. The translations I shall be quoting from are taken from the Quattro Coronati Lodge edition of the early French exposures, edited by the late Brother Harry Carr. My description starts off from Le Secret des Francs-Maçons of 1742, and then continues from La Désolation des Entrepreneurs Modernes of about 1747, because this then offers rather fuller and more interesting detail than the other. I'm abbreviating slightly here and there, and from time to time I shall interject a comment of my own. So we begin. When they take their place at table, the worshipful is seated first at the head in the east. The first and second wardens take their seats, facing the worshipful, in the west. Now, a point to note here is that both wardens are in the west, as they still are in continental lodges, and as, indeed, they were in lodges in England for much of the 18th century. We now only preserve this arrangement at the dinner table, with the wardens at either end of the base of a triangle, which has the master at its apex. But to continue the quotation, if it is an initiation meeting, the initiates have the place of honour, that is to say, they are seated right and left the worshipful. The table is always served with 3, 5, 7, or 9 courses. When they are all seated, each will have a bottle of wine before him. They did themselves rather well, didn't they? All the terms they use are borrowed from the artillery. The bottle is called a barrel. Wine and water are both called powder, except that the wine is called red powder, and the other white powder. One of the other exposures put it differently and somewhat more candidly. Wine was strong powder, and water was weak powder. The routine they observe in drinking does not permit the use of glasses, for there would not be a whole glass left after they had finished. They use only goblets, which they call cannon, firing glasses, in other words. When they drink in ceremony, the order is given, "Take your powder." Everybody rises, and the worshipful says, "Load." In the original French it is "chargez," "chargez vos canons," or, as we would say, "charge your glasses." Then each of them fills his goblets, and the commando, "Right hand to your arms, take aim, fire, grand fire." That is how they designate the three movements they are obliged to observe in drinking. And if you like to try and do these actions, as they are now described, you can't fail to be struck by their similarity to the fire we know. On the first, they stretch their hands to the goblet. On the second, they raise them as though presenting arms. And on the last, they drink. While drinking, they all watch the worshipful, so as not to take the cannon from their lips until he does, and to finish the whole exercise in unison and complete silence. The powder consumed, that is to say, the wine having been drunk, they resume the present arms. From there they carry the cannon to the left shoulder, then to the right, and resume the present. After repeating this manoeuvre 3 times, they strike their cannon on the table with 3 unequal beats, so that the first is followed closely by the second, with a longer space between the second and the third. In other words, in the rhythm of the third degree knocks, which finishes with a great blow, which they all give together on the table with their cannon. As soon as they have lowered their arms, their cannons or glasses, that is, they clap their hands 3 times 5 claps, the first 4 extremely fast, and the 5th a little delayed, after which they shout Vivat 3 times, raising their right hands and snapping the fingers of that hand like the sound of castanets. This is what they call drinking a health with all the honours of masonry by 3 times 3. So there it is, a description of Masonic fire as written in the 1740s, and for the most part it sounds very familiar. But you may say this was in France. What about England? Well, there are similar accounts in the English exposures, which began to appear in the 1760s, and these show that the same sort of customs were being practised in England. There is a distinct possibility that they were copied from the French, for, to some extent, these exposures all plagiarised each other, and the French ones had appeared over here in translation. As I said earlier, there were no printed ritual books in those days, and there are grounds for believing that these exposures were themselves used by Masons to help them in their lodge work, and so they may even have played a part in moulding our ritual and ceremonies at a time when these were still in process of development. So, bearing this in mind, just listen to this description of English Masonic fire from the second edition, 1763, of an important exposure with the title Jarkin and Boaz. The table being plentifully stored with wine and punch, etc., every man has a glass set before him, and he fills it with what he chooses, and as often as he pleases. They did themselves quite well, too. But he must drink his glass in turn, or at least keep the motion with the rest. When, therefore, a public health is given, the master fills first, and desires the brethren to charge their glasses. When this is supposed to be done, the master says, "Brethren, are you all charged?" The senior and junior wardens answer, "We are all charged in the south, we are all charged in the west." 1763 this, but familiar, isn't it? Then they all stand up, and observing the master's movements, like the soldier his right-hand man, they drink their glasses off. And if the master proposes the health or toast with 3 times 3 claps, they throw the glasses with the right hand at full length, bringing them across their throats 3 times, and making 3 motions to set them down on the table. At the third they are set down, though perhaps 50 in number, as if they was but one. Then raising their hands breast high, they clap 9 times against the right hand, divided into 3 divisions, which is termed drinking with 3 times 3. At the end they give a huzzah. So that is the origin of Masonic fire, without any doubt. But as to its meaning, now the speculatives can take over and build all sorts of symbolism around what was once a simple convivial custom. For example, the fire is said to represent the action of the stonemason as he spreads the mortar on the stonework, and so should be taken slowly. Or it is intended to echo the first degree sign. Although it has to be said that the symbolism of the spreading of cement and the movements of the first degree sign have come to be associated with it. But you will have gathered from what I've been saying that in my opinion there is no deep significance or symbolism in Masonic fire. It is simply a survival of a convivial custom originally carried out as a cheerful, boisterous routine. And so I consider that it can still today reflect its origins without any loss of dignity. So to my mind, Masonic fire should be carried out briskly. In musical terms, something between the prestissimo you come across here and there and the largo of elsewhere. Vivace, in other words, would seem to be the right description, for I can't help but feel that to treat it as something solemn and ponderous is to ignore its origins and to misapply symbolism. This raises a point one hears talked about quite often, whether the person calling the fire should say quick or good fire. But is it even necessary to qualify it at all? If we remember the artillery analogy of the practice, it could be argued that it is an imperative, a word of command. And so the call could be quite simply given as, "Fire, brethren, taking the time from me." Indeed, in some places, one hears the call given without any qualification as, "Honour the toast, brethren, taking the time from me," or words to that effect. There are occasionally arguments, too, about whether it is taking the time from or with me, but I cannot but observe that I have yet to hear a grand director of ceremonies in the craft calling upon the brethren to salute the occupant of the throne with anything but "taking the time from me." And another point, not your time, but the time. The form of giving Masonic fire varies in detail from place to place, and in some it is followed with musical honours, when the assembled company who have drunk the toast join in singing a series of short, repetitive verses. "Prosper the art," for a toast to an individual, and "Worthy Masons all," for a collective toast to a group of brethren, the verses being typically in threes, and accompanied at the end of each with a further "point left right" and a single clap. Talking of these musical honours reminds me that these and many other items appeared in Dr. William Sparks' Freemasons Liber Musicus, a book of music, chants, and songs for Masonic use, that was published 100 or so years ago, and one that in its day had a great vogue among lodge organists. And it's perhaps of interest to mention, and this in connection too with my talk on the other side of this tape, that the words given for "Worthy Masons all" in this book include the line, "The Queen and the Craft and the Mystic Tie." One variation of Masonic fire that you sometimes encounter, and one that really can only be called an aberration, is the so-called silent fire associated with the toast to brethren, the 9 o'clock toast, and occasionally with the Tyler's toast also. Now, although there are records way back into the 18th century of the health of absent members being drunk, the toast to absent brethren as a formal toast at a stated hour seems only to have come into being during the First World War and to have been widely adopted throughout the craft after that. The brethren remembered in this toast, and in the Tyler's toast for that matter, are only absent from lodge because they are perhaps ill or engaged on their private or public avocations. They have not departed this life, and if they had, any sort of fire would then seem to be altogether inappropriate. I've already made the point that in origin Masonic fire was a noisy and lively procedure, so that silent fire cannot be considered as anything but a contradiction in terms. The late Brother Harry Carr is on record as saying, "After a lengthy search, I must confess I was unable to find a single argument that could explain or justify silent fire." And I, for my part, cannot do other than agree with him. Before the end of this talk on customs of the festive board, I should like to make a few personal observations on some related subjects, wine-taking and the difference between this and formal toasts, and then finally go on to say a few words about the Tyler's toast. And perhaps I ought to remind you that, as elsewhere in this talk, I am referring to English practice. The taking of wine by the master with individual brethren or groups of brethren is something which all too often gets out of hand. The view has been expressed by leaders in the craft that it is a practice that should be kept to a minimum, so that the dignity of the after proceedings and the brethren's enjoyment of the meal and of their conversation with those around them is not constantly being interrupted by the crash of gavels, so that the master may indulge in what often seems an interminable series of wine-takings with various officers and brethren in every conceivable capacity, and with some in several. If the master takes wine with his wardens, as he should, since they, with him, are the principal officers of the lodge, if he takes wine with them, and then with all the brethren present, Everybody has been covered without any invidious singling out of individuals, and no further wine-takings need be necessary on normal occasions. It will be obvious, however, that there are other occasions when further wine-takings would be proper or might be considered desirable, such as when there is an official visitor to the lodge, a grand officer or a representative of the provincial or district grandmaster. On installation night, when the master would naturally wish to take wine with the installing master, or again, after an initiation, when he would also want to do so with the newly admitted brother, and so on. On the occasion of an initiation, though, it is not necessary for everyone to take wine with the initiate, for they will anyway be drinking his health as a formal toast later on. And that brings me to the difference between wine-takings and toasts. And there is a difference which doesn't always seem to be appreciated. When the master takes wine with an individual or group of brethren, all the participants stand, unless, as is well known, this would bring too many people to their feet, and so they are requested to remain seated. The essential symbolism of the taking of wine is that each of the parties stands and pledges the others. In other words, it is an exchange of mutual esteem and goodwill. When we come to the formal toast list which follows the conclusion of the meal, there's a nice distinction, however. In a toast, the health of an individual or group of brethren is being drunk by others as a one-way communication of respect, esteem, goodwill, call it what you like, directed by those in the toast to the subject of it. The subject of the toast, be it one or more persons, therefore remains seated, and he therefore, and this is the whole point, he therefore does not himself drink, for it is surely questionable form, I suggest, to sit and drink one's own health. There is one case which might seem to be an exception to this, apart from the obvious ones of absent brethren and the tireless toast, when the subjects aren't present anyway. But it's not an exception, since it follows logically from my argument, and I'm now referring to the toast of the lodge, as proposed on the occasion of one of its anniversaries, a 50th, a centenary, and so on. When such a toast is proposed, it is, I submit, proper that everyone, including the lodge members, should rise and drink to it, since it is not their health which is being drunk, they are not the subject of the toast, for the subject is the concept of the lodge as a body corporate, and so it is to its continued success and prosperity that the toast is directed. A hope and expectation for their lodge with which its members should surely wish to associate themselves. So they rise and drink too. Having mentioned the tireless toast, it seems appropriate that I should now conclude this talk with a brief comment on this, the final item on the Masonic toast list. The tireless toast is in fact the charge given at the conclusion of the third section of the first lecture, the first of the catechetical lectures of the 3 degrees of craft masonry, to give them their full title, that in their present form date from the union of the two grand lodges in 1813. However, the sentiments expressed in the toast are a good deal older than this and go back well into the previous century. An embryonic form of the tireless toast appears in the first edition, 1756, of Ahiman Raison, that curiously titled Book of Constitutions of the Ancients Grand Lodge. And it occurs after one of the many songs, and there are a lot of them, this is number 36, in a collection at the back of the book. They were meant for use at the after proceedings, and many have an appropriate toast to follow the singing of them, and there's no doubt they were used in this way in the 18th century. I wouldn't attempt to divert you by trying to sing this particular song, even if I knew the tune, which I don't. It's said to be mutual love, by the way, but I can't resist quoting the last two verses. My brethren all take glass in hand and toast our noble master grand, and in full chorus sing, and in full chorus sing. A health to ancient masons free throughout the globe, where'er they be, and so God save the king, and so God save the king. Then follows the toast, to all ancient masons, wheresoe'er dispersed or oppressed, round the globe, etc. A tantalizing etc. that in what it leaves unsaid. As a last observation on the tiler's toast, I should like to comment on a practice that has grown up among tilers, and that is the supplementing of the traditional toast with the reciting of a verse from a poem called The Final Toast, which was written in the 1840s by a brother D.L. Richardson in Calcutta, and originally published set to music. In that form it had 6 verses, somewhat sentimental in style, but it is only the last verse, Dear Brethren of the Mystic Tie, that has gained some currency. It should not be forgotten, however, that the tiler's toast is the one which traditionally should bring the entire proceedings to a close. The Richardson verse should on no account be allowed to take the place of the tiler's toast, and if it is given at all, it must precede that toast and not follow it. The final words the brethren should hear before they disperse are those time-hallowed ones with which I, too, am going to close. All poor and distressed masons were ever dispersed over the face of earth and water, wishing them a speedy relief of their sufferings and a safe return to their native country, if they desire it.